Perfection. It's worth pursuing. But what does it cost you? Your dignity, your relationships, your sanity? What if someone else did all the work of making something perfect, and you just got to enjoy their hard work? Well, then you'd have Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium fair trade Arabica beans. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf, half-caf, and a rotating seasonal blend for those of you who like to shake it up. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this exceptional coffee to your home or office within 1 week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor so that you can make a perfect cup of coffee right at home. You can order Sparkplug as you need it, or join the Sparkplug Autopilot Coffee Club for regular deliveries. The Autopilot Coffee Club is not a coffee of the month club. It's completely personalized and flexible, and comes with all kinds of member benefits. And we have great news for Top 100 listeners. If you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, that's all one word with the number 100, Sparkplug is now offering 20% off your next coffee order. That applies to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So what are you waiting for? Start making the best coffee you've ever had in your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Let's have fun. 5, 6, 7, 8.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Good job, everyone, and thanks for downloading the Next 165 Project, the nearly every Monday classic movies podcast. Our quest to talk about the 123 classics on the AFI's 1998 and 2007 lists of badass American movie films was completed a long time ago, so now we just chat about things that are our tempo. And spoilers are a-coming. I'm the black t-shirted bully who tried playing drums once and was terrible at it, Rock Band 3 Ryan Ellis. And here's the lady who doesn't rush or drag on the keyboard, but she does sweat and bleed all over it, my wife, Bev.
That's me.
Are you one of those single tier people?
It's going to be one of those podcasts, isn't it?
How many quotes have already been said in the first few minutes here? Okay, the coming attraction's opinion, not trivia, and it is about the character we've already quoted a few times, or I've already quoted a few times, J.K. Simmons, Fletcher in this film, the vicious drill instructor, effectively, because he's not so much a teacher in Whiplash as he is a vicious drill instructor. Who is the best drill instructor in movie history? I gave you some options. Maybe there's some other better ones I didn't think of, but Hartman in Full Metal Jacket, Louis Gossett Jr. in An Officer and a Gentleman, or even Fletcher in Whiplash.
I don't even think this is an opinion thing. I just think it's a fact that Full Metal Jacket, Arlie Ermey, is hands down, country mile, the best drill sergeant in cinema history.
So you're going with the ironically named Hartman.
Yeah.
A man who has no heart. I actually went with someone else, because I think that J.K. Simmons would be a great choice. He's a teacher, granted, but I think maybe Gossett in An Officer and Gentleman. Oscar winner, for one thing, although Ermey should have been nominated. Wasn't even nominated. Gossett's underrated amongst all the ones I mentioned and probably everybody else. Maybe people have even forgotten about him, but one thing I like about him is the humanity. Hartman wasn't in the movie that much in Full Metal Jacket, as iconic as that performance is. Gossett gets to have more layers, especially at the end, his last interaction with Richard Gere, Mayo. But I think Simmons in this movie would have been a great choice, too. So there's probably somebody else, but there you go. You got Ermey, and I'll take Gossett. And who could really argue with J.K. Simmons? Okay, he will be the focus in this movie, despite the supporting actor win he had, not the lead. So after being shown at festivals galore, Whiplash, was released by Blumhouse and about 47 other production companies 5 years ago in October 2014. And even though it didn't win Best Picture that year, it is my favorite movie of that year. It had a minuscule budget, but raked in nearly $50 million worldwide. Bev, you probably should remind people what this five-year-old movie is about with the Whiplash. Skinny.
Miles Teller is Andrew, a talented and ambitious jazz drumming student at a prestigious New York music academy, where he is drafted by the studio band leader J.K. Simmons' Fletcher, a notorious and cruel kingmaker. Fletcher's methods are staggeringly abusive and drive Andrew to a breakdown, leaving him to choose between his soul and a life of greatness, and leaving the audience to ponder whether souls are overrated, really.
Or, in a nutshell, I guess Andrew found Fletcher's tempo. And now his life is over. It does remind me a little bit of a movie that Chris and I are covering around the same time frame. In fact, that will go up a few days before this one goes up. The Wrestler. one-trick pony that is Mickey Rourke's character in that movie. Well, I guess that's what Andrew effectively wants to be, is a one-trick pony. He'd rather be great at one thing and one thing only. Nothing else can fit in his life. Not a girlfriend, maybe not even his father. The movie seems to imply at the end even his father is in his dust. All I have now is drumming. But I do think that's interesting, the comparison between The Wrestler and Whiplash, two of my favorite movies in those years. My second favorite movie of 2008, behind The Dark Knight, and my absolute favorite movie in 2014.
It's a counter-argument against the very American notion of exceptionalism being something to pursue. It's making the argument that it's not worth it, period. We
not for
should
you.
Be rooting for him to maybe not give up drumming, but give up trying to be the best.
Not for you, and maybe even not for me, but for him it is.
Yeah, but that's because he's broken. He was broken before he met Fletcher.
Why I wanted this movie, we're doing it right now,
is because... Yeah.
Not so much the argument, is that even I don't know how I feel about this movie, and I've seen it four times, maybe five times.
It has an ambiguous position. The movie doesn't tell you how you should feel.
I feel about it every time, even during it, and I bet in this podcast I will change my opinion within sentences. It's shitty what happens with Fletcher and Andrew, and it's awesome what happens with Andrew, because it's what he wants, but is it what he wants?
Is it what he should want?
That's one reason this movie stands out so much to me. I liked it the first time I saw it, loved it the second time, and I think I like it more and more every time I see it. Not many movies have done that for me, and maybe for anyone. Okay, well, the Rotten Tomatoes critics like this movie too. 93% of them, 273 fresh, and only 19 rotten, for an average of 8.5 out of 10, and 94% of audiences right in line with the critics. And it's still 45th on the IMDb's 250. 45th.
Wow.
They
Five
love
years later. That's
the
great.
Nerdy type films. Tarantino and Kubrick are way up there, and Nolan as well. Of course, Star Wars, Lord of the Rings. Shawshank is still number one. Dark Knight's way up there. The Godfather movies. But Whiplash, bit of a surprise there. Maybe because it's basically a boys' film, only a few girls, women in the whole movie.
It's pretty macho, too. It's not even just that there's no significant female characters.
But regardless, I'm surprised it's 45th. It did win three Oscars. Best Supporting Actor for J.K. Simmons, the editing, Tom Cross, and the sound team won as well. I think all very worthy nominations. The movie does hum along. It's only an hour and 40-ish, 45 minutes, something like that. And I didn't really feel the time going by at all. It felt like it started and ended in a matter of seconds. And it was also nominated for Best Picture and the adapted screenplay by Damien Chazelle. No Best Director nomination for this. Probably should have got that because he did a great job with one of his... Well, it was only his second ever movie and his first big movie, if this is really considered big. And actually, when you watch the Oscar wins, I just did that again this afternoon, Damien Chazelle has an awesome reaction when Tom Cross wins for the editing, and the sound team does too, especially Cross, who goes by him, and it's like he's looking for the handshake or the high five, but Chazelle is hugging Jason Blum. But anyway, Chazelle, when you see him as he's sitting down when Cross gives a speech, he's just so giddily happy for the guy. He's not even 30 years old when this movie gets made, though, and maybe that's part of the reason why. He's the youngest ever Best Director winner when he won the Oscar for La La Land a few years after this movie, and he was 32, I want to say. But I think he wasn't even 30 when this movie was made.
Maybe.
So he looks like a little kid, gleefully happy for his guys to have won, his friends probably, and certainly his collaborators. Anyway, what do you think about the five-year-old Whiplash?
Well, like you, I love this movie. It's intense and thoughtful. It's fiercely entertaining. Leaves you thinking about it long after it's over. We're talking about the technicals already. I think it's an amazing example of a very well-edited film. And economical storytelling, which is an underrated virtue. Also, it never tells when it can show.
Yeah.
It gives faith to the audience that they're going to figure out what's going on. Of course, the performances go a long way to convey a lot of information, particularly the very understated performance of Teller, who is playing chill Ying to the Fletcher Yang, the huge bombastic performance of Simmons. It's really just a twofer. Their performance really helps make the movie a lot as well. Maybe that's how Chazelle really captured lightning in a bottle. I still have optimism that he will make another great film, but I don't think he's ever met the bar that he set with Whiplash again.
We didn't love La La Land the second time we saw it. We liked it the first time more. We both thought after Moonlight won the Oscar, La La Land was right there with it. But when we saw La La Land later that same year, whenever it was, months and months after the Oscar and the snafu with all that, reading the wrong name, La La Land doesn't really hold up. And especially Ryan Gosling, not his fault, but the way Chazelle wrote him, Miles Teller in this movie is not supposed to be likable. He has that Social Network-esque scene with Melissa Benoist. And incidentally, I heard Chazelle pronounce that in a sit-down interview with Simmons and Teller with some guy. So I guess it is Benoist, not Benoist or anything.
I'm glad you said it because I didn't know.
I should do more of this. I meant
I was like,
to listen.
Is it French? Is it Benoit?
Well, it does look like that, doesn't it? I meant to listen to the commentary in this, but didn't get to it before we recorded the podcast. But anyway, so he has this possible relationship with her. She seems to like him back. But he literally tells her, not quite the same thing as Social Network, but very similar kind of thing where he's being condescending and literally telling her, I don't have time for you. There's no point in carrying this on. Oh, you're mad at me? Okay, that makes it even easier. And I think that in both scenes, you've got people, well, you've got a guy who's a bit touched, maybe, the way they portray him, at least in Social Network, a movie we'll probably cover next year, incidentally. And this guy who's just completely blinders on focused. I kind of admire that. This is, again, why this movie will drive me crazy in a great way. Because do I admire that or do I hate that? Simmons, in that same interview I talked about, that's about 10 minutes long, said, well, for me, and he's the guy who plays the awful teacher, if it was me, I'd rather have the girlfriend and a life of some kind.
He's a very successful actor, too, who surely has had to make sacrifices and choices to pursue the career that he's passionate about and that he's talented at, and he is considered one of the best. Maybe not one of the greats, but I don't know, he's in the conversation, at least for actors of his generation, and he's very beloved, and he can probably pick and choose whatever projects he wants at this point, too.
And now he's back as J. Jonah Jameson in the Spider-Man movies.
Is he really?
After having played him, I guess you haven't seen, this isn't really a spoiler now, it's been out for many months, but in Far From Home, the new Spider-Man movie that was out a few months ago, at the very end, I was about to walk out. I thought, I will see whatever's in the end credits when I get home on YouTube. But it started right before I walked out of the theater, and it's him being J. Jonah Jameson again.
Amazing.
Talking about Peter Parker being a menace! And of course, he's played Commissioner Gordon in the DC films, so he's played some major characters in the comic book films, but of course, he made his name probably first and foremost on a show I've never seen, but you've talked about how brutal it is. Why am I forgetting the name of it right now?
If you think Fletcher is a bad character, you should see his character in Oz. Just sum up what happens, I think, in the first few episodes. We meet him. He is the leader of the neo-Nazi gang in prison, and he befriends somebody who's just entered the prison and is totally, like, fish out of water. And
fresh fish. Fresh fish.
By the end of the episode, he's raped him and branded like a swastika into his arm with a cigarette. He's truly evil in that show.
Incidentally, there's a short, and it's on the Blu-ray, and I saw it. Actually, it was on YouTube, I saw it, but I think it's on the Blu-ray, too. Is what got this movie made. Because Chazelle had made one other film, not a big, well-known film, also about music. So he did the short with a guy named Johnny Simmons and J.K. Simmons. And you know what J.K. Simmons' real name is? Jonathan Kimball Simmons.
No.
So it's John Simmons and John Simmons. So Johnny Simmons plays Andrew. It's fascinating how similar the short is. Maybe it should be. It shouldn't be that you get a movie made and then you change the whole damn thing and then the producers say, well, this isn't what we bought, and you change this entirely. It is surprising, right down to some of the same lines. In the movie, there's a line where Fletcher is really at his worst, or one of his worst, where he says, I will fuck you like a pig. You don't see his face on camera. He does say that same line in the short, and you see his face on camera, and I heard that they actually used that audio from the short for the film because he didn't want to say it again the second time, I guess. Maybe because he thought the line was stupid and ridiculous. But why he said the first time, I don't know. But you should see that short, anybody, you or anyone listening right now, because it isn't very long, but you really get a synopsis of what this is. It's most of that first scene where he talks to Andrew nicely. Oh, your father, your mother, and gets all the information up against him and then uses it against him seconds later, which I guess is why he gets the information, and throwing the chair at Andrew. And Andrew messing up and all this other stuff where he's been built up in seconds and then torn down in half a second. But let's go back to the start of the film here. And the meaning of it, whiplash, has multiple meanings. I love when titles do that. So it's a piece of music that they play multiple times, including at the end. Although I guess he's actually playing Caravan. And it's supposed to be upswinging when Fletcher screws him over. But anyway, he does play whiplash more than once in this. It's also referring to the car accident that Andrew has at one point. He could have whiplash, but he's so determined with his really badly messed up left hand.
You see his finger in a cast later.
So obviously that could be a whiplash type of deal because of the car accident. And apparently Damien Chazelle himself was in a car accident at one point. So he can relate to that one.
While they were shooting the film, it was a small budget and it was a really short turnaround. I think they had an 18-day shooting schedule. Near the end, he was in a pretty bad car accident, but he had to just come in and work anyway.
And then Fletcher's abuse effectively gives somebody whiplash. By the way, you said that they shot this movie in not even a month. Mm. One of Simmons' competitors for the Oscar that year was Ethan Hawke on Boyhood. That was also a long shoot just because they shot over the course of, what was it, a dozen years. But effectively, Ethan Hawke worked for 12 years and Simmons worked for barely that many more days.
Yeah, who knows how many days he was even on set, because there's actually quite a few scenes that he's not in.
Although Miles Teller, I think, is in every scene in this movie. It's very Taxi Driver-esque in that way. Both an obsessed person, not a killer in this movie, but a person who's on screen, if not in every single scene, just about. There was going to be a scene with Simmons by himself in his apartment, And I think it was actually Jason Reitman, who was an executive producer on this, who told Chazelle, who was still new to filmmaking and obviously was listening to his producers, and this is a good piece of information, no, don't ever go away from Andrew's story. We'll learn enough about Fletcher. We don't need to see him by himself at home. And I think that's right. So in the very beginning of the film, the first thing we hear is Andrew playing that dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun- true to Fletcher and is going to play anyway after Fletcher sets him up by saying they're going to play one thing, but then, I know it was you. Is this supposed to be the ultimate test at the end? How good can you improv? And either I humiliate you and you walk away feeling stupid, which he does briefly, or you rise to the challenge and you really are that good and I win either way. It's win-win for him. But let's get back into the second, because I just want to talk about that very beginning thing where he plays and plays and then gets faster. And that's reprised at the end. But also Fletcher comes into that room, hangs up his jacket, and then in the ending, he takes off the jacket. So I love these connections to the beginning and the ending where it's, okay, this guy's got talent. I already know this. Just like when he scopes him out later on when he's in basically junior varsity drumming, Andrew, that is. And Fletcher comes in there. Let's see what you got. Are you just pretty or you got the first chair for a reason? No, just pretty. None of that matters. It's all about having Andrew be tested, who's not even the main drummer in the junior varsity, if you want to call it that, because it is Connolly who's the main drummer. Later on, he's brought in as motivation for Andrew. But there are some nice connections there. And I think the idea that Fletcher takes off his jacket and then, whoops-a-daisy, forgot my jacket. Like, he always does in this movie. He's fucking with him. But at the end, when he takes it off and sets it aside and does that whole sort of, okay, you guys all ready? He's in, Andrew's in. And this whole thing seemed to be a big setup to try to get this guy to be great. And if he wasn't great, what's Fletcher lost?
So the first time I saw this movie, my thoughts were Fletcher, who would bomb a show, risking the careers of himself and the rest of his band just to get revenge on Andrew. So that's like where he's starting this show. But then Andrew surprises him. In the moment, Fletcher is either A, trying to save face and pretend like, I knew this was going to happen all along, gets to take credit for his success and confirm that his teaching methods are actually right, or what I really believe, because I just think Fletcher is a straight-up sadist. I don't think he cares about music. I don't think he cares about his students. I think he cares about the pleasure he gets from making people suffer. He's giving him this positive affirmation because he knows when it's over, he still has Andrew in the palm of his hand, at least in some way, and he'll get revenge on him some other way. That's okay. I have time. I can make this even sweeter. Let me build you up that much more, and then when I tear you down, it'll be that much more satisfying.
Well, Fletcher's look at the end, just see his eyes. It's one hell of a tight close-up. It says to me, I got him. And the question is, was that the plan all along?
Well, in the rest of the film, Simmons' performance is that he is a person acting. He's always putting on a performance, whether he's performing the nice teacher who's kind, who's curious, who wants to foster talent, who's really just trying to do the right thing by his students and believes in his methods.
Who we see talking to a former student and a kid, and seems to actually like the guy and is nice to the kid.
Although, do we even know that guy is a former student of his?
I think so. He also seems to, I mean, Fletcher seems to care about Sean Casey. When he talks about, he performs
that he cares about Sean Casey.
Because he does lies to his students about the fact that he died, yeah. And then we find out later that the guy actually hung himself. Now, how much responsibility for that is Fletcher's?
I don't think Fletcher cares.
That's not the question I'm asking, though. Do you think that it's his responsibility?
I don't know. We never meet Sean Casey. We have no idea.
No matter how hard a teacher is on you, if you hang yourself, then there's something deeply wrong with you beyond a tough teacher.
But that doesn't mean that a tough teacher can't take a vulnerable person and push them over the edge.
Absolutely, okay.
People can be, in a way, responsible for taking a vulnerable person and pushing them to the point of hurting themselves, even suicide. I'm sorry, but people are responsible for the pain that they cause others, and especially when they're vulnerable like that. He's a performer. He performs kindness, and he performs grief. I guess he's upset about Sean Casey dying. I don't really know. Because I don't believe anything that he shows.
You think
especially
he's a big fake.
When his students are the audience. Because he's putting on this performance. And then what is the very next thing he does after Sean Casey dies? He uses his grief as permission to then be astronomically cruel to his students. He makes everybody else wait around while he makes those drummers take turns until they're literally bleeding on the drum kit.
It's 2 a.m.
Until it's 2 a.m. They started at, what, 9 o'clock at night?
Something like
they're
that.
They're sweating, they're in pain, they're miserable.
Are they ever going to get better at that point
well,
either?
That's just it. He also knows at the beginning of that who he's going to choose. I also don't believe for 1 second that he's doing anything but stringing along the other drummers. He sees something in Andrew that makes him a perfect victim. Because Andrew, right from the beginning of the film, is broken. He knows how to pick a victim, and he knows how to groom a victim. The fact is also that broken people can be very successful. They can be really high achievers. There's a common thing that when somebody is very successful, you will learn that they were abandoned by a parent. Success is the best revenge.
And that happened to Andrew with his mother.
I'll never know them, but won't they be sorry they abandoned me when they see that I'm the greatest drummer in the world? Won't they wish that they had stuck around to know me and I will prove to them that I am valuable and I am worthy of love? Fletcher turns that against him, but it could be part of the reason why Andrew is broken from the beginning, why he's obsessed with being one of the greats, as he says, why he can't just be happy like a lot of other people in the movie, including his father. Paul Reiser, as his father Jim, is probably the only other character that has anything close to what you might consider a backstory or personality of significance, because he's this really sweet guy. He really loves his kid. I love good Reiser, although he plays a great villain.
Aliens.
Yeah. So Jim is a pushover. He gets bullied by his brother-in-law. He apologizes to the guy that hits him in the head with the popcorn at the theater. He's sweet. He's a dad, like I said. It's a curiosity that he couldn't get through to Andrew. Whatever Andrew's dysfunction is, his emotional hole is too great to be filled with the honest love of a good father. Like Jim, he's like a man with a bucket earnestly trying to bail out the Titanic. And he's doomed to fail right from the beginning, no matter what he does.
It's a competitive family, maybe not so much Jim. But just as that dinner scene starts, before the two cousins come in, and then that's where that scene is really well known, I guess, probably the whole thing of, come play with us. Four words you'll never hear from the NFL. That great comeback. Really excellent writing when Andrew says that. But before any of that happens, when that scene first starts, you hear something about Jim, the meat sucks. Whatever the line is, I sure wrote that down. So when that scene first begins, you've got the older generation with a bullying guy saying, oh, the dinner you've invited us over for, not good enough. Who does that? Almost ever. Even in a family.
It's almost overkill, that scene.
But I didn't notice it before, so it can't be too much overkill. I didn't notice.
But I just mean like the bullying nature of the family, how they take over, and they're so dismissive of Andrew. They seem to have active contempt for him.
I think that is absolutely accurate. I haven't dealt with that personally. But here's a guy who's an artist versus two guys who are playing football. And Andrew already, at 19 years old, has a chance to go on to great things. He's already doing great things, actually. These other guys are doing, if you think about it, mediocre things. I always remember my high school football coach, not my coach, I didn't play football, but he was one of the math teachers, I don't know, I never liked the guy, chemistry, what the fuck it was. I think he was referring to me, because most of the guys that were the jockey types, and I was sort of that, as I probably said in this podcast before, I was that, and I was a lot of other things, sort of a nerd, sort of a jock, sort of a lot of things. Something about you regret playing football. I've never regretted not playing football in high school, including for my brain's sake. I do regret not being in drama. Mr. Lane reminds me of Andrew's uncle.
Yeah, those jocks. I watched a review of the film by an academically trained jazz musician. A lot of his observations, and he admitted this, are really pedantic about what he found realistic and what he didn't. But he said that dinner scene where none of the family, even his father, really understand or appreciate his accomplishments, that was the scene that had the most emotionally accurate portrayal in the whole film. He's like, that's the one that got under my skin, because when you're a jazz musician, your accomplishments, they just don't translate to other people. They're just so unfamiliar with it.
I'm trying to think of something obscure, but let's see if he mastered it. Looking around the room here, let's see if he mastered frame making or drop ceilings. But you're talking about that at a dinner, and maybe you're the best at it in the world, or even just the best at it in New York, and everyone else does the, and that's a wonderful pursuit, I am sure. Now, on to my sons with something I do understand that all of us can basically understand. If you know anything about football, you know what football is. But who really knows what jazz drumming is?
You know what I'm thinking of is that great documentary Wordplay about competitive crossword puzzlers. Mm. There's a woman who says her boyfriend, her ex-boyfriend, used to complain that she talked about it all the time because she had won. And she was like, if you were the best in the world at something, wouldn't you talk about it?
It doesn't matter what it is. Anything.
She was the best in the world at this.
And he looked down at her.
Well, yeah, he wasn't impressed or it annoyed him that she talked about it. No, I'm the best in the world. I get to brag about it.
Because he is like Andrew's uncle. Mm. All right, let's get back to the bad dad. We've been talking about the good dad, because I think you're right. Paul Reiser is a good dad. He's very supportive. One of the most important shots in the movie might be the last time we see him when he's looking through the doorway. Because Andrew had walked out and Jim had hugged him. It's going to be okay. But Andrew doesn't want that. He doesn't want to be supported in that moment. And I think in a way, not to say he'll never talk to his dad or be around his dad anymore, but when he goes back to those drums, he might as well shove him off, literally, and say, no, the dad I need and the dad I want, for whatever his faults are, is in that room. he's going to push me in a way that you can't and you won't, because you don't understand, because he didn't understand much about the drumming at that dinner scene either. And that leads me into something, and this is why this movie, in a good way, a great way, frustrates me so much, because I don't really ever know how I even feel about it. Because I had great and supportive teachers throughout my schooling, especially in high school, but even in grade school and in college. I was never great at anything. Pretty decent athlete, relatively intelligent, sense of humor. Not bad at any one thing, probably. Not really terrible at most things I ever try, but not great at anything. So the point is, in school, I'm not blaming my teachers, but if they'd pushed me, could I have been better? Could I have ever been a professional athlete? No, probably not, but I love baseball. And back in my youth, I loved hockey. I can't even skate, but I loved hockey, probably as much as baseball for a few years there. And I just wonder if I'd been pushed that kind of way. But then teachers need to know who will respond to this sort of abuse, because some will. And Andrew clearly is the kind of person who will, just like Charlie Parker, Bird. Although the real story about him apparently is that he didn't go back the next day and practice harder. He gave it up for weeks and months, much like Andrew does later on.
Also, they never threw the symbol at his head. They threw the symbol on the ground.
To basically scare him,
I guess. He had like a hissy fit. He didn't try to hurt him.
And even that apparently made Charlie Parker say, well, I guess I'll give it up for a little while. I don't know if I really believe that Andrew would ever give up drumming the way he does for what seems to be months. Because it's what he's obsessed with.
He has like a full breakdown. Maybe I don't believe he would pick up drumsticks and drum on his kit. But he would have gotten kicked out of Schaefer. And he maybe would take a breather because he'd have to take a step back and be like, wow, I, in shock, with possibly a concussion and a broken finger, got on stage covered in blood and tried to perform. He was this single-minded. Mm-hmm. And Fletcher's response wasn't to see a teenager covered in blood and be like, wait, something's clearly off. His response was to be like, what's wrong with you? You're playing like shit.
And he has a great excuse because he was in a car accident, but he was late for the performance. Fletcher doesn't know why he was late, I don't think.
It's because of the bus. There was a flat in the bus.
And then the car, and he forgets his sticks. Good reasons, but he was late. I'm just saying, I'll probably disagree with myself in the next 2 minutes, but if somebody's already really good at something, baseball, drumming, cooking, I don't know, you name it, anything they could be great at, a politician, and somebody pushes them hard, and they know or they guess, because a lot of us have to be guessing, that man or woman, or boy or girl probably, can take it. Maybe someone else couldn't, but somehow they intuit that an Andrew Neiman, by the way, his name is not Neiman, which is what Fletcher always calls him. You hear Andrew say his name in the very beginning, Neiman, and you hear somebody else say Neiman, whatever, whatever, one of his classmates. So Fletcher, deliberately or not, is mispronouncing his name through the whole movie, and he almost always calls him by his last name until the end, Andrew, what are you doing, man? But then I guess he's accepted. So the question is, and I think Simmons says that in that making of, I think I saw that sit-down interview that the three of them did, but is it necessary to bully anyone like this? You see the black teacher who's teaching that younger group, Andrew's first class, he's very polite. But Andrew, I think, needs to be pushed, even if it has to be viciously, because he does respond. But it's a risk, because if he doesn't respond, and also, when the guy throws the chair at his head, when Fletcher does that, what if he hit him? Or if he'd hit the pianist, because they're all in that same area.
And he's concentrating on what he's doing. What if he hit him in the face with a chair?
Is that not a lawsuit?
So it's equal parts frustrating and radical that the film truly doesn't express an opinion either way about whether or not we should approve of Fletcher's extreme, but apparently, at least in Andrew's case, effective methods. I don't like these methods. I like that the film does this. I think it serves to make it more interesting, and probably one of the reasons I keep coming back to it, that and the fact that it is relentlessly entertaining. The argument you're missing when you talk about this, well, it's worth it if it makes him great, but what if greatness isn't worth it?
It is to Andrew.
Because he's messed up.
That's your opinion.
Because he's in pain.
That is your opinion.
Yes, that is my opinion. I've been a performer before. I was a stand-up comic, and I've known lots of people who are professional performers in one way or another, and when I gave up comedy, one of the things I said is I was agreeing to the terms set by the entertainment industry to take part in the entertainment industry. Just agreeing to do that and pursuing it should be a category in the DSM. That it should right away suggest that there is something fundamentally troubled about someone because it is just so messed up. The people I saw who were ambitious, there were definitely exceptions. There were some really well-adjusted people who were just hardworking and into it, and they were often the most successful ones, but there were so many people who were motivated by something else. Let's say, I'm not going to pretend to know them. My experience with performers, particularly the very motivated ones, is that it doesn't come from a good place. it comes from a broken place.
I think that's your opinion. And also, you're now in a pretty ordinary life with me. Mm. We're happy together. We have great dogs. We have friends. We have family.
We have a great podcast. Don't forget.
Comedians, though, tend to be broken people to begin with. And would Robin Williams, look where he went. Look what happened to him. Would he give up what he had, though, in that 60 or so years? I don't know if he would. I don't know. I'm just saying that we can't relate to these people in the first place. Barry Bonds, when he was a kid, was probably pushed hard by his dad and by his godfather, Willie Mays, of all people. And he became one of the great players of all time, but also a raging fucking prick. Unliked by, it seemed like, almost everybody in baseball. But arguably, and forget the drugs, one of the greatest players. Well, he is one of. He might be the greatest player who ever lived. And would he be that? I don't know if he was pushed hard by his dad. I'm speculating. Would he be that if he hadn't been pushed hard in his youth? When that's what you want, and you're willing to accept that, and willing to take the hits, as Rocky would say, you gotta take the hits and get back up. Andrew wants to take the hits, and you're saying that the Rockies of the world, the Andrews of the world, the Charlie Parkers of the world, should want to take the hits. And if Andrew dies at 30, like Charlie Parker did, whatever age it was, maybe Charlie Parker was happy, maybe he wasn't, maybe Andrew Naaman is happy, maybe he won't be. But that's what they wanted, if not what they always want, in the whole course of their lives. So who are you to say? And also, they're more special to the world than you and I will ever be.
Does the world probably really lose that much value?
Yes.
If the home run record,
yes,
is not beat
special
by Barry Bonds?
People change the world. Special people have always changed the world for the good and for the bad. The person in charge of America, God, I hate talking about this guy. I shouldn't even bring it up, I guess, but he's not special. But he pushed himself, obviously, for all of his faults to a certain point. Anybody who gets to that position probably does. I think these kinds of people set the tone in the whole world.
Okay, you've had ups and downs in your life. Would you give it all up and live in the worst mental state you've ever had in exchange for a successful baseball career? To be one of the greatest baseball players? Would you give up happiness?
I think it's possible to have both in that kind of world.
Not in Whiplash. We're arguing about Whiplash. So in the world of Whiplash.
But you said baseball.
This is like a sports movie, right?
Chris and I could have covered this for Scoring at the Movies.
Seriously, it really follows a sports movie with like a coach rather than a conductor because they don't even seem to care about music. There's no real passion for music. They don't talk about music. It's all about this achievement of playing faster, matching the tempo, and playing through the pain. Things that you don't really associate with musicians. There's never passion. They don't seem to even enjoy playing music, listening to it, play any
It's a nice touch when you see the class come in after he's been told to show up at 6 a.m. and he's late for that. He's always rushing, by the way. He falls then. The car accident, he's rushing. Rushing and dragging. And incidentally, I think I can tell now after seeing the movie this many times when he's rushing in that sequence, when it builds up, I'm going to fuck you like a pig and throws a chair at him. When he's been told he's rushing and dragging and he's getting slapped, which apparently J.K. Simmons did for real. Teller suffered in this movie. He actually bled. Some of that blood was really his on the drums, on his hands and whatnot because he was a trained drummer. He's actually done this before. But one of the many things that Fletcher does to fuck with him is by saying, show up at 6 a.m. and don't be late. But nobody's there for 3 hours because that's when band always starts. So that's just an excuse yet again for Fletcher to do that to him. But at least he's prepared. But he is late in the first place. Why would he oversleep on his big day? You think he'd be up at 5, 4 a.m.? Mm. I'm so jazzed up, no pun intended, ready to go that whole day. But one of the many things Fletcher does to fuck with people, what happened to that folder? Did Fletcher take it?
He took it.
It is on that chair for seconds. And Andrew's attention is taken away for just a few seconds. But then Carl's the one who's punished for it. How'd you forget the folder? And he shouldn't have. Why would you entrust it to your underling? He always treats him badly because Carl knows that Andrew's eventually going to take
another
his job.
Another sports movie thing. The way there's no camaraderie in this band. Actually, that's a strange thing about this movie. He has no relationship with the other musicians. When he's
or
on the bus.
Or not friends either. We see that.
No.
Very important, maybe 3 seconds of the movie when he goes to his dorm room. No friends. Yeah. Nobody even acknowledges him. He doesn't acknowledge them back.
How weird is it that when he's going to that performance where he gets in the car accident, he's on a bus by himself. The whole band.
Yeah.
Why isn't he going with them? You tell me that they experience all this abuse and they never just go for a drink afterwards and commiserate about what Fletcher puts them through?
Maybe they do, but another sports analogy is that he's the rookie, so he's out of it. Until he proves himself after a few months or a year, then he's in.
Yeah. You did avoid answering my question about whether you would choose happiness or to be, let's say, hold the home run record, but you would be unhappy. As unhappy as the darkest moments in your life.
I've actually thought about this recently, that the little things, it's a butterfly effect kind of deal, right? If I hadn't gone to school to be into television broadcasting, if I'd gone to some other schooling, I probably wouldn't have gotten a job at the CBC. And those kinds of steps probably lead me to meeting you, because I didn't meet you through my job, but in a way, being in Toronto is because
we connected because we have similar jobs.
I think it's
jobs
one to one to one. Those things can lead to the other thing, I think. So I wouldn't know you if I hadn't gone down this road. So I can never regret where my life is right now because my job, for whatever its faults are, did lead me to you. So would I want to give that up? No. But unlike so many husbands or wives, would just say, no, dear, never, never, never. Nope, I won't admit what I'm really thinking. There's a part of me, and this is why this movie fascinates me so much, that has to be thinking, even not saying right in this podcast, admitting, I don't know. Because there's a part of me that wishes I was better at everything that I am. You and I have talked many times, like I'm home from a game and we'll play well. Maybe we won the game, maybe we didn't. Usually we do. And you'll say, how did I do personally? And I had 3 hits, but I got out one time, and I should have got a hit.
Yeah, you really do.
And I will dwell on the one mistake. That's what Andrew does. That's what Fletcher does. That's what great people, I'm not great, but that's what great people can do. Although it's interesting, when we see Fletcher playing piano that one time in that jazz bar.
So vanilla.
He's kind of dragging.
It's like hotel lobby jazz. It's so unimpressive.
But those who can't do, teach.
Right. It has to be intentional, because there's no flair to his performance at all.
You talked a few minutes ago about the band. By the way, when they enter in the very beginning, when Andrew's been waiting for hours for them to show up, they're all talking, full of life. They seem to know each other, get along pretty well. But as soon as Fletcher comes in, they're cowed and silent. And then we see the scene where he intimidates and kicks out the heavyset guy. There's no fucking bars bar on the floor. Some funny stuff, by the way, as bullying as it is. And there's some SJW failures because Fletcher does use some homophobic slurs in that scene, I think, in there. But that's probably partly, at least, to make an impression on Andrew.
Yeah, when he walks in the room, everybody, yeah, eyes to the floor. This is a great example of show, don't tell. We don't ever see him abuse the other musicians
don't
the
need
way
to.
He abuses the drummers. We don't need to, exactly. We see how they are, and we know that this week it's the drummers, but last week it was the woodwinds, and the week before that it was the bass. Do you also notice that they cast almost exclusively handsome young men,
mm-hmm.
all taller.
Decent mix, though. Quite a few black people in there.
Sure.
Maybe a few Asians.
Miles Teller, great actor, not a great looker. He's not a Hollywood hot guy by a long shot. He's surrounded by all these dudes that just look like masters of the universe. And all dudes, not a single woman in his entire band.
The end sequence, there are girls. Women,
he's in
I should say.
That
yeah.
other band, there
yeah.
is one woman.
But not in school, yeah.
In Bones. She's playing the trombone. She's in the Bones section.
You're talking
section.
About the end sequence?
Yeah.
I think I saw more than one.
There was the woman that
far and away more men, granted. I'll give
you
that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But in this band, it's exclusively dudes. Mm. And they're all hot, except for the one guy that he picks on and kicks out of band, lying to him saying he's out of tune, mm. or just berating him until he says he's out of tune because he probably just doesn't even know it's true anymore.
Mm.
The amount of bullying, you would just say anything to make him lose focus.
One of the things that's so messed up about Fletcher, though, is he wants perfection. But they're playing jazz. Isn't jazz supposed to be messy, full of improvs, that kind of stuff? One of my favorite movies in the 90s, okay, not one of my 10 favorites, but I don't know, in the top 200 at least, would be That Thing You Do, Tom Hanks' directorial debut. Another jazz drummer. I was going to have it. That Thing You Fucking Do is going to be my nutshell for this, by the way. But Tom Everett Scott is the guy who loves jazz, goes to a jazz club and hear doodly-doo, and he's so into it. Now, those guys aren't making mistakes, but if they had, is the Tom Everett Scott character going to care or judge them? It's going to be, well, you just make the mistake like in, what do you call it, the tango. Pacino and Sent of a Woman. Make a mistake and tango on. Well, same idea with jazz. You're not supposed to be perfect. Although maybe the idea is when you're 19, 20 years old, learn it and learn it and learn it. Just like in baseball, learn your swing. Get perfect at that. Do it hundreds of thousands of times, probably literally at that age. And then when you get to be 25, 30, 35 years old, and you're supposed to be at the peak of your profession, it's kind of like the line in Apocalypse Now where you see the making of, where Francis Ford Coppola says to Dennis Hopper, you have to know your lines before you can forget your lines.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, you have to perfect your craft before you can start breaking it. Picasso was an excellent technical painter. He could paint photorealism, but he decided to paint like a child. You have to know what you're doing first. So I think that's part of it. One of the things when I talk about how I saw that review by an academically trained jazz musician, he acknowledged people are a little more chill about jazz music specifically. Also, one of the things he pointed out was that a place in the Carnegie Hall band, you're a working musician and that's great, but it's kind of equivalent to being a session musician if you're in jazz. He's like, that's a terrible standard for being a successful jazz musician. So they're playing these concerts at Carnegie Hall, but that's not really where jazz is measured. Jazz is measured in jazz clubs. But he seconded what you pointed out about the homophobia. The macho-ness actually is very real. The homophobic slurs, unfortunately, that is a big part of
I think that in
musicians.
Locker rooms right now, if you could get in there and hear the truth, and these guys could be as uncensored as they want to be. They're racist, and they're homophobic, and they're using things like pussy, so women slurs, even now, even though people are supposed to be more woke, because that's what it always was, and that'll probably change eventually, but it hasn't yet. And again, we're saying, this could have been a podcast for Chris and I to do, because it might as well be a sports movie.
Yeah, oh yeah. It would be ironic if he was also racist, because white people didn't invent jazz music. Mm.
But the movie's not, because it does have quite a few non-whites in the bands. We see the various bands. When Andrew is still in the one with Connolly, where he's the main drummer, then the main part of the movie, and then the one at the very end. A lot of people who aren't white, so that's good at least. When Andrew does give up the drumming for a little while, he has a normal life. He thinks about Nicole. He calls her, realizes she's found somebody else, and he missed his chance. That's kind of a sad thing in a way, but it's also, you're 19 years old. She was never going to be, okay, maybe she might have been, but she was unlikely to be the love of your life. Movies so often have shown people that meet whatever age they are, and that's the one! And yet you meet so many people, especially when you're 19, will there be 4 or 5 or 20 more, and that'll be the one. So it's not all that tragic.
She's like a stick figure of a character, too. So she's just a symbol of him having a connection with somebody.
But I think Benoist in her brief screen time is pretty good. She's from Glee, Supergirl on TV, of course. One of the only girls, women in the whole movie, and I think she does a pretty good job in that small part. Because
it's very appealing.
Yes, for sure. And it gives him motivation to drive this normal life. But then he sees Fletcher in that club, and then maybe the most important scene in the whole film, where Fletcher's completely normal, no shouting, no intimidation. He's just talking to Andrew. It could still be more of his play. Is this an actor who plays a guy who is always acting, who's always performing? Although when he's mad, I don't think that's always necessarily putting on an act. Maybe it is. It's almost like if you'd gotten a drill instructor. I mentioned that in the beginning of the podcast. And if you could just stop, have a big pause, and then somebody says, so Ermy in Full Metal Jacket, Gossett in An Officer and a Gentleman, those characters they're playing. So what do you really think of some of these people? He's not bad. He's got potential. She's pretty good, too. And
they, but we know.
But are they just acting that whole time? Because that's yes. The gig. And one of the reasons I mentioned Gossett over Ermy is that some of the things you hear Ermy say, as great as he is, are what you hear Gossett say 5 years before. So I think in some ways, Full Metal Jacket is aping that one deliberately, because that's probably what happens in thousands and thousands of boot camps all over the world all the time.
Okay, but back to Fletcher, we know that he's putting on a show.
So it's a routine he's maybe done before with other people.
Yeah, he is pretending to be nice to him, and it's in this scene that he says the line that you quote all the time, which mm-hmm. is, there are no two words in the English language more harmful than, good job. We used to have these neighbors that had this little kid, and their nanny would hang out in the backyard with him all day, and would just hear her all the time over and over again. Good job.
What that kid was doing.
Good job.
There was such a good job.
He was like 1.5. We learn later when he looks Andrew in the eye, he says, I know it was you. He always knew. So he is a performer. We never see the real Fletcher. We only see him through Andrew, and we can never trust anything that he's showing Andrew, because the whole thing is a con.
What if Fletcher didn't run into Andrew at the club? Andrew has no reason to go in there. It's not like he was invited. He just happens to see that Fletcher's playing piano, so I'll go in and watch this, and
well,
they have a nice
Fletcher
conversation.
Never would have gotten
so
his...
is there no third act?
No, I guess not. But,
well,
you
it's,
know,
a movie.
It's a movie. There's some really nice subtle touches in that moment. The montage where Andrew is just trying to carry on with his life when he's just walking down the street and he sees the posters for the jazz festival, all these little touches, and you see the pull. Something must have drawn him to jazz in the first place, but more than anything, it's the thing that he's good at that he's found has rewarded him. And if you've dedicated that much of your life to becoming good at this one thing, well, the chances of you being great at anything else at this point are probably pretty slim.
Well, I love the scene, whether he's being honest or not, because he does have that moment. And maybe that's why I always struggle with this movie, when this guy is telling you his motivations, but you can't even necessarily trust what he's telling you, which is the two most harmful words are good job, because you do say that when you play sports with people that aren't very good at them. Not that I'm the greatest either. Somebody has a pathetic at bat and they ground a third or something like that and they're out by 10 feet. Good try. But if you're being fully honest, a lot of times you'd say, that wasn't a very good try. Or they strike out, or they make a really bad error. I've thought it 1,000 times. I've rarely said it. I hope I haven't expressed it, even in body language. I probably have. I don't want to. I'm trying not to be that way anymore, at least. But you're thinking, and I can't be the only one that does this, even at the level of ball that I play. It isn't a good job. It isn't good enough. Partly because that's what I do to myself. Like I told you a few minutes ago, if I have a good game, but it's not as good as it could have been, especially if our team didn't succeed, didn't win, then I'm going to feel like it wasn't a good job. So then we lead into the longest drum solo in movie history, probably, unless there's something else I'm not thinking of. What does the audience watching this think of all this, by the way? When Andrew, first of all, isn't playing very well and then walks off, Fletcher apologizes, but then Andrew just comes in and does his own solo for a long time. It's multiple clips on YouTube. When I post this podcast, it probably still will be. It's something like 10 or even 12 minutes of that sequence alone. The band plays, but it's mostly Andrew drumming, and it is fascinating to watch. He's playing Caravan, but he fucks up Upswinging. And like I said, I think Whiplash is part of that somehow. I don't really understand. I don't really know the song. And at the end, Fletcher's tight close-up says, I got him, and Andrew's fully in. One of the few smiles Andrew has in the whole film. When he pauses and Fletcher looks at him, and cut to black. Kind of like in The Wrestler, like I said, we just talked about that a few days ago for scoring at the movies. What's really going to happen next? And we always get into that now, the last few weeks. What does happen next?
I already told you what I think happens next.
I think Andrew does nothing but drum. He becomes a legend, maybe, possibly, and probably dies at 30. But that's
does
what
he hang himself?
I don't know, but that's what he seems to want, or he at least accepts it, and I have to respect that to a degree. But I also have to ask, has Fletcher truly forgiven him for being fired?
Nope.
But then he does come up to him and fixes the drum and says, Andrew, what are you doing, man? Whole different tone than he had in the whole film. It's not Neiman or Naaman, maybe. He'll finally call him by the right last name, maybe in the future, but he does have a different tone.
He's a monster. He will get his revenge some other way.
I think it's possibly he's forgiven him. I don't know. It's hard to say because this is what Fletcher wanted all along. He wanted to help create a great. Incidentally, a Fletcher is someone who puts feathers on arrows. So he's preparing the next bird, as in Charlie Parker.
Oh, that's nice. That's great.
Thank you, IMDb.
It's just a great scene. If you watch it on its own without context.
I have lots of times.
It is just so entertaining. It's technically a marvel.
Excellent
of
editing. Just,
I've watched a billion music videos in my life and this is right up there as far as technically making you really feel the music, too. It's such a brilliant piece of work. And it's triumphant. So you are happy to see Andrew triumph over Fletcher, but also just as an artist, you know, in this room full of people who matter. And he's proving to them that he is going to be one of the greats. And as an audience member watching the film, you can't help but be carried away and root for him. This is amazing. This is what you want. And then it cuts to black. And then immediately you're like, oh no, he's lost.
If his dad stays out of his way, they can have a relationship. If he doesn't, then maybe not, because I think he's got a new dad.
It's awful. It's heartbreaking. It's a tragedy, really.
This is what the guy wants.
It's a tragedy, then, that this is what he wants.
So Miles Teller was in Footloose. He's the one who plays the Chris Penn role in that movie. It's weird casting, because Chris Penn is so great in the first Footloose. Miles Teller, I don't remember in the movie. I know he's in it. And also in Fantastic Four, because he is Mr. Fantastic. And he'll be in Top Gun Maverick. But he's not been in Chazelle's last couple of films, because, of course, that was Ryan Gosling in La La Land and First Man. Teller was experienced with the drums, so you can tell he's playing a lot of it. I'm sure he didn't play every bit of it, especially when you have the sound. This sometimes looks like it's out of sync from what I can really tell on this kind of thing. But it's hard to keep up with that kind of sound in the first place. So to even get close, kudos to the sound department for that, and they did win an award for it. And Andrew's wearing white when we first meet him in the very opening, but then he's all in black when he's bought in at the end. And Fletcher is always wearing the same black t-shirt, and when he wears a jacket, it tends to be, I think always, a black jacket. The other two drummers, Nate Lang is Carl Tanner, who was only in three films. He trained the other two drummers, Austin Stowell, who plays Ryan Connolly, and then I don't know if Miles Teller needed to be trained as much, but he helped him out too. When the folder goes missing, Carl says, you know, I have to read the music. But Andrew, at the end, is off book. Off book, of course, is more of an acting expression where you know your lines.
In that scene with Carl, he's off book.
Yeah, even then he knows exactly.
Yeah, that's why he gets to play.
But at the end, when he's improvising, he doesn't even need to read the music anymore. But Carl only gets by, ever. Even if Carl was dedicated to one piece, you don't get the feeling that he could ever just play without having the notes in front of him.
He's a line about how he's
like, not special.
It's a thing. Yeah.
And I'm not judging him. I'm not judging him at all. But he, in this world, in the world of sports, I guess again, you could say, is not special. And Fletcher wants the guy who's special. So Damien Chazelle did write and direct this film. He based it on his own experiences as a jazz drummer who also had a tough instructor, so he can really relate to that one. This was such a quick shoot. Jason Blum, Ben Wilkins, and Thomas Curley were the producers, and then, of course, Jason Reitman was an executive producer. What do you think of Chazelle's direction? I guess you like it, I do too. Not nominated for the Oscar, for whatever that's worth. The winner that year, appropriately, because we like Birdman, which we covered this year, in fact, was Inarritu
2. Also a great jazz score.
Mm-hmm. And a terrific film, terrifically entertaining film. Supposedly mostly one shot. They faked a lot of that. This is not anything like that. This does have a lot of edits in it, but not over-edited. Unlike this year's Oscar winner and music film as well, Bohemian Rhapsody.
And won the editing Oscar. Mm-hmm.
But this one should have.
I've already ranted and raved about that.
So what about Chazelle and the production and all that kind of thing?
Oh, I think it's wonderful. I can't imagine how he made something that was just this tight as a drum. I know I use that phrase all the time. It's like super appropriate here. It is just tight as a drum. There just doesn't seem to be anything that doesn't need to be there, that doesn't belong, that doesn't make the movie better. You get these two phenomenal performances. The editing is outstanding. It has an incredible flow to it. The pacing is perfect. I think his direction is outstanding. It's been actually quite disappointing that he's never been able to get lightning in a bottle again.
He didn't love First Man.
I didn't actively hate First Man, but I found it very disappointing. La La Land was very fun in the first viewing, second viewing really let us down. Has lots to like about it, but as a whole, and actually from an editing perspective, both La La Land and First Man are way too long.
That's true, and La La Land, in retrospect, should not have won the Best Picture Oscar that night, so that controversy aside, we'll always remember the Moonlight one for that reason alone. Had they gotten it right, maybe the Moonlight would already be forgotten by the average person, not by us. But I'm glad they got it right, because you look back and think, La La Land, beautiful looking, and the actors do a good job. I like Emma Stone, probably shouldn't have won. Gosling certainly shouldn't have won, I wouldn't say.
Last 10 minutes are phenomenal.
Yes. But Moonlight is the better movie, and Chazelle has not been as good as he was with this film. First Man is fine, but I feel like I've seen that kind of thing before, and I didn't really care the same way. Apollo 13 we're going to cover next year when it's 25 years old. I've seen that movie 100 times, probably. I've seen some of the scenes at least that many times. The one where they're coming back to Earth. I know it was real, and they actually got back to Earth, and I've seen that scene so many times, yet I'm still on the edge of my seat. Oh my God, they got back, thank God. First Man has the same issues going on with it, and I didn't care the same way, and maybe it's just the way it was done, I don't know. But I do love the music in First Man. It won the Golden Globe. Justin Hurwitz won that, and he won two Oscars for La La Land. Does the music in this film. And we've already talked about the editing and the camera work. By the way, Sharon, I guess is how you pronounce his name. It is a guy, so Sharon with an E. Meir, I don't know how you pronounce his name. M-E-I-R. Well, we talked about the editing already. What did you think of the look and then the music in this? Because the music, I guess, isn't really written by him. Caravan and Whiplash, I think, are existing pieces of music.
I hate jazz.
I like it when it's done well.
This movie and La La Land can just confirm that I hate jazz. And there's, in both movies, a scene where a guy on a date is trying to convince his date, who hates jazz, they're wrong. And they should like jazz. And it rubs me all the wrong ways.
I've been there, though, the whole talking over something with somebody you're into that they should be trying to enjoy. I did that to you once when we watched a movie.
Which movie?
I think it was for the same reason, that I was into you and nervous and just didn't know how to shut the hell up and enjoy the moment. I think it was Music and Lyrics. Is that what it is? Or one of those?
I've never seen that. Oh, you mean the first movie we actually rented and saw together?
Something like that.
It was Go the Distance. I couldn't tell you what happened in that movie because you talked over the whole thing.
And that is what Ryan Gosling's doing in La La Land. You see what he's doing here right now? Would you just let her listen to it? Maybe she'll enjoy it more if you will. This movie, by the way, is 239-1. We watched the Blu-ray. I had to make sure to buy that. I think it was on Netflix, and yet I still either bought it or asked for it for Christmas because I thought, this movie deserves to be bought. It's got to be in our collection, and that's why we own it, because even though I think it's still on Netflix, or at least it was for a long time, it's there and it should be. One of the best movies of this decade, and I like Birdman. But this is definitely better. All right, then, last thoughts on Whiplash.
I agree with you. I love this movie. It gets better with every viewing. No matter how much I don't like jazz, I can overcome it.
But we don't agree fully because we don't agree on the motivations, and I don't even always agree with myself.
The ambiguity is built in. It's baked into it.
Well, you can like that. At least that's good. Yeah, and certainly, yeah. So can I. But for the final father-fucking time, I love this movie, and I still can't reconcile my own feelings about it. There's a part of me that wishes somebody to push me, and there's a part of me that can absolutely respect when somebody pushes somebody else. And I don't think you feel the same way, and that's fine.
Nope. We talked about this being a macho movie. I think that women are a little bit exempt from the pressure to be amazing.
Maybe they shouldn't be.
In the sense that maybe they shouldn't be. Why would you be happy when you could be great?
That's subjective.
I guess.
Andrew would tell you he's happy being great at music. We could discuss this movie all day long, keep on going back and forth. Okay, in 7 days, it will be September 30th, but we're going to get a 1 day's head start on Scary Movie Month. We'll head down to the Deep South and eat some questionable barbecue as we devour the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which we watched in the early part of September, even though usually I would watch that movie, and often have, on Halloween night itself, so I've already seen it almost 2 months before. The coming attractions trivia for the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and of course I'm talking about the original 1974 version, that is 45 years ago. How many people die in this flick, and how many die by chainsaw?
All right, so for the answer to that question, check out our next podcast about Texas Chainsaw Massacre. In the meantime, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe or favorite the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify, where all of our over 300 episodes are available for free. And that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American films ever made, and many, many more titles on top of that. In exchange for all this great content, perhaps you could leave us a rating and a review that helps people find us. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at BevEllisAllis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 20% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT. That's all one word, TOP100PROJECT, and it's not case sensitive.
More harmful than a chainsaw in your gut or even a chair being thrown at your head are the words, good job.
Good job.
That would have been the nutshell if people would have gotten it, but we had to.
It's an inside joke.
Good job.
And cut.